So hopefully this week's recording will work. We continue with our introduction. Yes, this is one of the people to the Isabel system. And first with a summary of what we saw last time. I think I now have to refocus on this. Yes, okay. So summary of last week's material. We saw the data type command in action that defined various recursive types and non-recursive ones like lists and numbers. And we saw function definitions for recursive functions. And we saw the very important proof principle of induction that performs structural induction on some variable of some type that was defined by a data type. And we also saw the auto proof command that tries to simplify all the sub-goals as much as possible. And remember that simplification means that this particular proof command only uses equalities from left to right. And this is really the major workhorse of the system. So the last line is something to remember all the time. And these proofs that we saw so far were of a very simple nature. You just started by giving the lemma statement, always with a name, and then a couple of applies that applied particular proof commands to the proof state. And once you're finished, you can write down done to indicate this is the end of the proof. And if your lemma is really some lemma that you want to be used all the time as a simplification rule, then you should add this annotation to the lemma name, and that means all subsequent proofs will use this lemma implicitly as a simplification rule, of course only in proof commands that use simplification like auto does. And I didn't show you this, but it can be quite useful. For top-down proofs, there is yet another proof command called sorry, and it'll just complete any proof, but complete in quotes in the sense that the system accepts the proof for now, but it remembers that it's not complete. And so if you run these proofs in batch mode, they will actually fail, not in an interactive mode, but interactively it can be used to say, well, accept it for now, and let's see what I can do with this lemma. And so you can do a top-down proof, you can assume a couple of lemmas, and see if they really get you where you're trying to get, and then you go back and prove them. Of course, it may then turn out that you've assumed a lemma that you can't prove, but on the other hand, it's equally annoying if you prove some lemma and then you find out later that it's useless. It'll give you some freedom to mix top-down and bottom-up approaches to proving lemmas. Yeah, so this is the ability that it gives you. And I didn't say anything about the proof state as you see it in the output, and I'll do that now. So this is the general form of the proof state that's shown in the output window. And it starts, I mean, there may be more than one sub-goal, and they're all numbered. And what are the different ingredients here? Let's go through it as on the slide. So these universally quantified variables, so this is a kind of universal quantifier that says, just consider the names x1 to xp that are mentioned here in the prefix as fixed local variables. They're typically introduced in inductions where you have to prove something for an arbitrary but fixed instance of a certain variable. And so just assume those are like constants, you can almost think of them. And then the A is the assumption, or there might be multiple assumptions for that sub-goal, and the B is the actual thing that you're trying to prove. But the A's are at your disposal, you can use them, or rather the proof methods can use them. And if you toggle the right switches, somewhere in there's this little tutorial programming and proving, it says somewhere which switch you can toggle, and then you don't see these nested or iterated implications of all the assumptions A1 to AN implying B, but you see this more compact and clearer notation that those are the assumptions and this is the conclusion. So the question of whether you see this or this is just a question of toggling some switches in the JEdit interface. But in any case, it means the A's are the assumptions and the B is the conclusion that you're trying to prove. And you can read the semicolon up here like an AND. So that was just a rough recap of what we saw last time. And now I would like to focus briefly on something that comes up in a couple of places during the course, not necessarily right now, but this is a good point to mention it. You shouldn't try and memorize everything I say now about numeric types, but once more than the natural numbers enter, the integers and the reals, then it's a good point to go back to these slides and remind yourself what were the important points about numeric types. So we have three numeric types. There are others, but those are the three that are relevant for us: the natural numbers, the integers, and the real numbers. And there are conversion functions. So these are really three different types, like in programming languages, except those are not the integers of a fixed length, but those are really the integers as the mathematicians like them, and similarly for the reals here. And we have conversion functions that take you from one type to another, take you up in the hierarchy. So int converts from a natural number to an integer, real converts from a natural number to a real, and then we have real of int that converts from integers to reals. And the preference in the basic libraries is that you should try and work with natural numbers as much as possible. That is, if you don't need negative numbers, and only then upgrade to the integers, and of course reals only if you really need real numbers. And nat and int are part of main. If you need the reals, then you should not start with the theory main, but you should start with the theory complex main that contains the real and the complex numbers. So that's why I'm saying don't try to remember all of this, but do remember that once you need more of these numeric types, then it's a good idea to go back and read those slides. Now, these conversion functions are inserted automatically, the conversion functions that convert up from nat to int to real. That is, if you are in complex main, then they are inserted automatically. So here, here's a little caveat. There might be multiple ways of inserting these conversion functions to make your input statement well-typed, and the system will choose an arbitrary one. So if there are multiple possibilities, you should make sure that either you don't care which one is chosen, or you should fix a particular one by inserting enough conversions yourself. So here's an example. If you write down I plus N, and somehow from the context it's clear that I is a natural number, and N is, I is an integer and N is a natural number, and you write a plus between, then there is no ambiguity. The only thing the system can do here is it can insert the int conversion and upgrades the natural number to an integer. On the other hand, if you write down something like this, N plus N, and say, oh, this is an expression that should be of type real, then the system will have to insert conversions to make it of type real, because currently N plus N is of type nat. But now there are two possibilities. Do we first add the two numbers N and N together and then make them in real, or do we first convert N and N separately to a real and then add them? And so both of these are perfectly fine completions of this expression here with conversion function to really make it a well-typed expression. And the system will actually show you what it's done, but you should be aware that if you don't write the conversion function yourself, the system will insert them, and the system might not insert them at the very exact place that you expect them. So what else? We also have conversions in the other direction. Let's call them coercions. So for example, there's the NAT coercion that takes an integer back to a natural number. Those are not inserted automatically because they really change the semantics. So why is that? Because if you apply the function NAT to a negative integer, it actually gives you the number zero back. So it's not, it loses information. And there are similar ones, floor and ceiling, to convert between reals and integers. They are there, but you have to use them explicitly. And then many of the arithmetic operations are overloaded, in particular the basic arithmetic. So it works for any numeric type A, same for the unary negation, I mean minus. Division actually is only defined for, of course, not for reals. There is a division for reals, that's the usual slash, but there's also a separate one for nat and int with div and mod. And yeah, right, there's the division on reals. And then we have exponentiation, and that's a bit tricky. We have some variance here. So we have an exponentiation with a natural number. So your base can be any numeric type, in fact, more than numeric types. And your exponent is a natural number, and you, in some sense, iterate that thing here n times. Or you can actually have a very general exponentiation, the power function that works in particular for the real numbers, where all of these three types are the same. So real to the real gives you back a real. Here you can actually do something like, I think you can even write the exponentiation of a function here. If you write f to the n with this notation, with the infix up arrow, that means the n time iteration of function f. So this is, these are really not comparable, they are different functions. And then there's an absolute value function that works for integers, reals, and many other types. Yeah, and the binary functions are all infix. So this is just a short overview of the different basic numeric operations. And in particular, you have to be careful with division, which works and is called different things on different types, and also exponentiation. So that was a review of last week, and B, a short overview of numeric types, and now I will come on. I will move on to the main content of this lecture: type and function definitions. So we have already seen specific instances. Now I will give you a more general view. How are types defined? So most frequently, when you define a new type, it will be a data type, and the syntax is similar to the syntax you see in functional languages. So you introduce a data type T, which may have argument types, and like lists over some type. And in case there's more than one argument type, then you have to use these parentheses around the argument types. And then you list the constructors that generate the values of the data type. And you, for every constructor, you list the argument types. And I don't want to pronounce this too many indices. And what does that do? The result of such a data type statement is that the system now knows about the type T that you've introduced, and it knows about all the constructors, and it knows the constructors have the following type, namely every constructor CI has the type. The argument types that you have listed up here, and the result type will always be to the type T that you're currently defining. So these are the constructors that define T. Then the system will also know about some properties of these constructors. It will know that they're all distinct. So two expressions that start with different constructors will necessarily be different values. So if the constructors are different, then Ci of one of some arguments is definitely distinct from Cj of some other arguments. It will also know about injectivity that if you have two constructor terms that start with the same constructor, so in contrast here we have different constructors that are at the top of the expression, here we have the same constructor, and then these two here are equal if and only if, so notice it's an equal, but this is an equal between values of the data type, this is an equal between booleans, so it's an if and only if. So these two expressions are equal if and only if all the arguments are component-wise equal. The first argument of the left-hand side is equal to the first argument of the right-hand side, and so on. So this is more, well, so this is really a very specific property of data types, both the distinctness but also the injectivity. So here's an example of, first a question. The injectivity in one direction, I mean, this is an if and only if here, but in one direction, it holds in general. You don't have to assume that the Ci is a data type constructor. So which of the two directions, left to right or right to left, of this equality hold in general, irrespective of the Cs?
Right to left.
Right to left, exactly. If these arguments are all the same, then of course the result of applying the same function to them will also be the same. That's just the property of functions. On the other hand, the direction from left to right, that's the non-trivial one, that's the injectivity, and that only holds for data type constructors. So if you think of some other function like the addition, say on natural numbers, this is certainly not true that x plus x1 plus x2 equals y1 plus y2 implies that x1 is equal to y1 and x2 is equal to y2. That's nonsense in general. And similarly for distinctness, say you couldn't infer that if x1 plus x2 that is distinct from y1 times y2. So this would be an example of the distinctness here. This is a very specific property of data types that doesn't hold for arbitrary functions like plus and times. And finally, we have the property, finally we have a property that I'm not writing down because it's so cumbersome to write down in full generality, in the induction rule that holds for every data type. And the point is the distinctness and injectivity, they are applied automatically in the background. For example, the auto proof method knows about that and will use these rules automatically. Induction must be applied explicitly. So if you want to do induction, structural induction over the data type, then you have to do so with the help of the induction proof method, and then you see what the result is. So that's why I'm not writing down the form of the induction rule, and it has lots of indices and it's not very readable. So there is the data type definition also generates new syntax. So for whenever you have an expression over a data type, you can take the expression apart, so to speak, using case expressions of this form, like in functional languages. So T must be of some data type, and then you can have different patterns and give different results depending on which pattern matches the actual value of T. And I'm just warning you, although you can write down complicated nested patterns, beware, the more complicated your code is, your patterns are, the more complicated your proofs will be. So always strive for simplicity, because in the end, you'll spend 5% of your time writing down the definitions, and you'll spend 95% of your time writing down the proofs. So it's worth saving on the proofs. and here the case, like the if then else, needs parentheses around it if it occurs in some other expression. And now let's just take a very quick look at an example of such a data type beyond numbers and lists, the tree data type. Oops. There we are. So here I don't think we even want to see the output at the moment. So, well, we could. Right, now we got it. So here's the definition of the data type, and we will see trees again and again and again in this course, so this is the very first time, and we call, for the trees, we call the two constructors leaf. You can think of it as the empty tree, and a node which consists of two subtrees, and in the middle, in the actual information stored in that node. And here is a little example of a property of trees that is proved automatically, namely that the leaf is always distinct from any node. So you can see here the tilde equality is just an ASCII way of writing unequals, because if we now look at the output, you can see the output now has been converted to this unequal sign, but this is the ASCII equivalent. And then, in fact, you can see something here that from time to time comes in useful. The system tries to, for every statement that you write down, every lemma statement, it tries to find in the database if that lemma has already been proved. And here it says, yes, you can directly prove this lemma with, down here, there are actually two different lemmas that already prove what you're trying to prove, or at least two different names for the same lemma. You could use those names, but of course it's even simpler to just ask auto to do it, and auto will do it, because it's one of those basic properties, the distinctness that auto knows about and applies automatically. Now here's a little function on trees, and there's nothing special about this function. It's mirroring a tree, and of course if you mirror a node of a left subtree, the information, and the right subtree, you get another node, but you have to mirror the two subtrees and swap them, and that's all there is to it. Here's a simple example. If you want to know what is the value of the, you mirror this particular tree here, then of course you can see the output down there where the A and the B are in a different order now, and you can see it's still not fully evaluated because this T here is an arbitrary tree. It's a tree variable, and so the system couldn't really evaluate this completely. There's still this unevaluated subterm mirror of T, but it gives you a good example of this value command and its ability to work symbolically in some situations. And now we want to prove that if you mirror a tree twice, you get the same tree back. And the proof is very simple, both on paper and also here on the machine. So you state this lemma. And the only thing I wanted to say, to show you is that if you now do the induction, something special happens. So you get two sub-goals. The first one is mirror of leaf is leaf, so that's this statement where the T has been substituted by leaf. And the second one is the induction step, this one. So you introduce two arbitrary trees, T1, T2, and some value X2, and then you want to show that mirror of node of these three components is again that same node. assuming that the mirroring the subtrees twice gives you back the same subtrees. So that shows you here an example of an induction schema that has multiple assumptions. Typically, for natural numbers, you just have one assumption that it works for the smaller number, for the list that it works for the smaller list. Here, you assume you have two assumptions, it works for both subtrees. But otherwise, there's nothing special about this induction. And the fact that you have two assumptions simply comes from the fact that if we go back to the data type, then the definition of the data type, a node has two subtrees. So if you do an induction, you can assume that both of them have that property already. And now here we are in the lucky situation that this proof is so simple that the induction goes through directly. Auto will do it. It's, if you do it on a sheet of paper, it's equally simple. Question, why is it so easy? Why is it so much easier to prove that mirroring gives you back the same tree as opposed to the lists that we had last time where we had a reverse function on lists and we wanted to prove that reversing the list twice gives you back the same list? But it was really complicated. It required something like three or four additional lemmas. Why is this simpler? What makes this example different from the previous example? Yep.
The reverse relied on the AND function.
That's exactly. The more functions you have in play, the more properties of functions and properties of interactions between functions you have to prove. Here you have just one function mirror, and it doesn't, in fact, there's nothing additionally that you would need to know, and in particular, there's no interaction between mirror and another function. So that's another a hint that try to simplify your life by having a simple setup. And then your proofs will also be simpler than if you have lots of functions. Right. This, I think, is for later. So any questions about the tree example? Then let me continue. Here's another very useful type that will come up again and again, the option type. And you can think of it as taking a type A and wrapping it up in a box in some sense. And values of A option can either be none, you can think of it as the box is empty, or it's some A, think of it as, well, there's one element in the box. And so the values, if the type A has the value A1, A2, and so on, then A option has the values, there's always the possibility there's no value of type A, or some A1, some A2, and so on. So you're just effectively adding another value to that type, except that you can't just add it in. You have to make sure that it's really distinct from all the values that are already in the type, and so you tag all the values that are already in the type with a sum constructor, and then you add the none to it. But the intention is you just add some arrow element or something like this to your type. And here's a typical application, a lookup function that takes a list of pairs, an association list, think of it as a key value list, and takes a key and gives you back a value, except that the key might not be in the list and therefore it can't always give you back a value, and that's why it possibly gives you back no value or none. And so if the list is empty, you just return none, and if it's non-empty, well then of course what you do is you compare the X with the A, and if the X is really equal to the A, then you return what?
Some B,
and if it's not equal, then you recurse. So this is a very typical example of how to use the option type to indicate in the return value of your function whether this or that happened. function definitions. We already saw some, now we'll see some more and look at a little more details. So there is also the possibility to define non-recursive functions just as a definition. Here's an example of the squaring function. That's just a shorthand for that's just defined to be n multiplied with itself. And note, it's simpler than the function definition command. It's non-recursive, and on the left-hand side, you don't have pattern matching. You can only write f applied to a list of variables equals some term. So it's sometimes useful, but for actual functions that do work on recursive data structures, it's not necessary. Now, here's a little justification of why in HOL everything must terminate. So here's an example. What could we deduce if we allowed such a function definition, if we allowed a recursive function, f of x is f of x plus 1? Now, as a programmer, there's nothing wrong with that, it just doesn't terminate. But in the system, when you write down an equation defining a function, that equation will then become a property of that function. So if you were allowed to define that function, then you would then get a fact that this property holds. And what could you deduce from that fact? I'm claiming you could deduce an inconsistency, you could deduce false from it. Why? How could you do that? You can subtract f of x in both sides, and then you have 0 equals 1. So that's why this wouldn't be a good idea if we were to allow a function definition like that in HOL. So we have the requirement that all functions must be total, and the trade-off that you have is either you do what we do in HOL, we force everything to be total, but then, I mean, you can define fewer functions, but on the other hand, your theorem proving process is much simpler because you never have to ask yourself, is this function defined on this value or is it undefined? No, all the functions are defined, so you never have to bother about that. There are more complicated logics where functions can be undefined, but that typically leads to a more cumbersome proof process because in many situations you suddenly have to prove that something is defined and it'll just slow down, that's the wrong word, but it reduced the degree of automation. And in HOL, we've just taken the decision, okay, we are prepared to live with functions where they have to be defined everywhere, but we prefer the improved proof automation. So, key features of the function definition command, fun. We already saw that we have pattern matching over data type constructors on the left-hand side of the function definitions of the defining equations. The order of equations matters. I'll show you examples of that in a moment. And termination must be provable automatically by the system using size measures. Now, I'm not going into details. Most of the time, this will be pretty straightforward. And what is the size? Well, the size of a natural number is simply that natural number. The size of a list is its length. The size of the tree is the number of nodes in the tree. So it's fairly intuitive. I think if we run into examples where we need to be clever about this, then the exercise sheet or the homework sheet will give you all the information because there are extensions of this function command that allow more more liberal termination proofs, but then you have to do them by hand and that is not something I want to go into because it's fairly infrequent and then we can always discuss it at that point where we need it. And finally, this is important for the subsequent proofs, that once you define a function recursively, you get a specialized induction schema for that function. And that will often be much more useful than the general induction principle that comes from a data type. And now we will go through examples demonstrating these points. So here is an example that shows that the order of equations matters. So this is the separator function that takes a separator, a list, and inserts the separator between all the elements of the list. So if the list has at least two elements, x and y, at the beginning, then the result is x followed by that separator, followed by the remainder, where you separate the remainder list by a. And this is easily seen to be terminating even by the system, because the length of this list here is a bit greater than the length of this list. So the size decreases when you go from left to right in the recursion equation. But it also shows that the order of equation matters. In the second equation, we simply say that the separator of any list is equal to that list. But of course, what we mean is any list that doesn't match the first line. So how many lists does that leave? That leaves us essentially just with two lists, the empty list and the singleton list. And of course, both the empty list and the singleton list, you can't separate any elements in there, because there's just at most one element in it. And that's why we can write it like this. The system will know about this. And in fact, what the system will do, it'll say, well, this is really an abbreviation for excluding all the patterns that are matched further up. And so I am treating this just as a shorthand. So I am pre-processing this input, and I am instantiating the variable x's with all the patterns that are not matched. And then I'm converting that single equation into all these specializations. And so the system will treat the second equation as a shorthand for sep A and x is x, the list with a single element, and the second equation, sep A and the empty list is the empty list. And at this point, These become equations in the system. They are facts, they are theorems. This is not a theorem, because you couldn't possibly prove that the separator function doesn't do anything on any list. In this process of converting your input in pre-processing in the input, it also turns the equations into what you can think of as conditional equations, because this is conditional on the fact that x does not match the pattern above. It turns these conditional equations into unconditional ones that are just equal, that are just true as they are. And I think we can even see that example here. Right. Here I've already written it the way one would write it if one wanted to avoid this pre-processing step. I can just change it for the sake of argument. The system will also give you some diagnostic information with this orange little icon on the left. And here you can see that it explicitly complains that you're missing some patterns. You don't have to give them, but you might want to. So if you now write sep A x's equals x's, I want A, this one. The system accepts it, and how can you tell that the system has actually pre-processed this second equation and turned it into these two equations? What you can ask, there is this, as a result of such a function definition, the system will create a named list of equations, and they are called the function name dot simps. So the simplification rules that come from this function definition. And now you can see quite clearly, the first one is the one that you wrote down. And the second, the other two, those are the specializations of your second rule. And the system has inferred that automatically from your definitions. A prereq is a restricted version of function, and I'll just gloss over it because we don't need to. It's more of historical importance, but these days you should always use fun. And now I want to discuss induction heuristics that go beyond what we discussed last time and that are necessary to perform more complicated inductions. And as the basic induction heuristic we already saw last time, if you have a recursive function and you want to prove a theorem about it, you had better prove that theorem by induction. And more so, you should induct on argument number I of the function if f is defined by recursion on that argument. So we had these questions last time. If you have the append function, it's defined by recursion on the first argument. And if the append function occurs in your statement that you're trying to prove, well, you had better do induction on that first argument. But then, of course, if the append function occurs multiple times, it may not be completely clear which of the different variables to induct on. So this is just a heuristic. And now, to demonstrate further heuristics, I would like to discuss an optimization. So this is the application, is I want to prove correct an optimization of this initial reverse function that we saw last time that takes the list and reverses it. And in the recursive case, remember what we did. If we reversed the list, we moved the head of the list to the end of the list, and we appended the reversal of the tail to the front of that single element. And this is, as somebody pointed out earlier, the complication is caused by having this append function in here as well. But that's not just a complication in terms of proofs, it's also a complication in terms of complexity. And so as a programmer, this is not a nice function definition, because what is the complexity of this reversal? Anybody know? If you have n elements on the in the input, what's the complexity of reversing a list of length n in that manner? Remember that the append function, this is the append function in standard notation in the system, is defined by recursion of the first argument. So it'll take as long as the first argument is long. So that means if you think of the very first recursive call of reverse, you reverse a list that's almost as long as the whole list, and then you append it to the front. So you again have, here you have a recursion on that list, and then you have another append that takes as long as that list is. But inside you have more appends, but of course on somewhat shorter lists. So what you get is you get actually from all the appends, you get a sum of 1 up to n, which gives you a quadratic complexity. So this is not ideal from a complexity point of view. So now we're trying to define a tail recursive version. What does tail recursive mean? It means that the system that any decent compiler, and there are lots of indecent ones out there, can convert this into a loop rather than a recursion with a stack that needs to be created and then later retracted. And so tail recursion essentially means that if you look at the right-hand side, the recursive, the right-hand side of the recursion equations, the application of the recursive function is always at the very end. So it's something of this form. in this case, it would be, in general, if you have a recursion equation, then it had better be of this form, that the f is again at the very outside, because it means essentially you perform some work and then you jump back to the beginning of f. Whereas here, you perform some work, but you can then can't jump back, but you have to remember that the result of that work and then also create this, do some additional work afterwards. This is not the most general form. It could also be that it's something like if blah blah blah, then f of and else something else. So this is not the only possible pattern. It doesn't have to be at the very end, except that this is also at the very end, because the if then else will happen first and then this will happen. I don't want to define formally what tail recursion is, but I think it'll be pretty obvious. This iterative reverse, that's what it stands for, iterative reverse, takes one list, that's the one that you want to reverse, and a second list, that's what's called the accumulator, where the end result gradually is accumulated, is built up, and if the first list is exhausted, you return the second list. And if the first list is not exhausted, what you do is you just take from the list that you want to reverse the first element and put it at the front of the second list. And then you call yourself recursively. So this here is just a functional way of writing down a loop that says, while the first list is not empty, take an element from the first list, take the head of the first list, move it onto the second list, and then just continue the loop. So this will generate efficient code, and we should now try and prove that it does the same. It has the same input-output relationship, that if you now call itref with the list you want to reverse and the empty list, that this is in fact the same result as reversing it here according to this more intuitive definition. Here it's not as intuitive that you'd really do the reversal, but what you essentially do, you can think of it as having a pack of cards in your hand and putting down one card after the other on the table, and when you're finished, you have on the table a reversed list of your reversed pack of cards. So let's try and prove this on the machine. Induction demo. So you can already see the system is processing it, has processed it, and the final done, there's a squiggle underneath it, and there's a red mark to the left of it, and in the output window it says failed to finish proof, so this proof did not work. So what happened, that's just without all this red, this is the statement. Induction generates two subgoals. Auto cleans up the base case, but it can't solve the induction step, because there is a mismatch. Where's the mismatch? Why doesn't the induction hypothesis on the left of the arrow help us to prove anything about the inductive step on the right? Yep.
Because the accumulator is empty.
Yes. So what happened after one, after the itref function has taken one step, it has moved the first element from the list into the accumulator, it's no longer empty, so the induction hypothesis no longer helps us. We have two specialized in induction hypothesis, which is absolutely standard the situation. You frequently have to generalize your inductive statement to make it provable by induction.
And what's too special about it here, you're proving the a property of itref that only talks about the empty list as an as a second argument, but you need to know how itref works for an arbitrary second argument so that you can use it irrespective of whether it has zero, one, or two elements in it. So we need to generalize it, and well, you can trivially generalize it by putting in a variable, but now the system says, well, as you've written it down, this is simply not true. I found a counterexample. So the art of generalizing a statement is not just replace here a constant by a variable, but you also have to generalize the statement. You have to change the statement. And how do you have to change it here? How does itref behave? It clearly has, it can't just ignore its second argument. That has to come into play as well. This is the, but of course this requires a deeper understanding of how the function works. So it's not a trivial step to come to that, to come there. And now the system doesn't complain that it finds counterexamples. That's not a proof that there aren't counterexamples, but at least we are more hopeful this time. Induction on axis, and now auto, still can't prove it. Now here, this is more of a technicality and less a problem in principle. So if we look at this statement that we have here, well, we can see that it doesn't quite work out either. Why not? Because if we look at the, let's just look at the left-hand side, itref of x's and y's, but here in the conclusion, we have itref of x's and A cons wise. So this is clearly not the same list. It's a list that's one longer. Why can't we use it? We can't use it because we really, in the whole statement, there's just one list wise. And here we are saying, well, if we append something to that, if we reverse something onto that wise, then you get something. But here we want to know what happens if you reverse something onto that very wise, which is also where there's also an A in front. So what's missing here is what you really meant when you wrote down that goal here, that this should be true for all wise. And you can do that. You can put in a universal quantifier here. Oops. And the proof goes through now. So what's the difference? The difference is now, I don't need to turn around. Let's look at goal number two. So now we have a universally quantified induction hypothesis that says for all y's this statement holds, and therefore we will be able to use it down here where the y's, we don't see this anymore because auto will just prove it, but in one step you can see what happens in one step from this currently highlighted term, the A will move across to the second argument. But then you can still use the induction hypothesis because it says, well, okay, that works for any value in the second argument. So it doesn't matter that the value is now no longer wise, it's A cons wise. So that's the key idea here. And in principle, you can do this with the universal quantifier, but I recommend not to. It leads to other complications. And so there is a much specialized way of dealing with this, and the specialized way is that in the induction you already say, I want to prove this, but I want to prove it for arbitrary values of y's, not just for one fixed value but for all values. And so there's a modifier here, you can write arbitrary and then y's, And then what you get looks pretty similar to what we had, except it's now using this other universal quantifier from the, say, the ambient logic, the context that we're in, and then the system can deal with it slightly more gracefully, and it's just the more convenient way of doing things. But logically, it's exactly the same as putting a quantifier in front of it, except you don't write the quantifier, and you don't clutter up your lemma statement with quantifiers, but it's part of the proof. And again, the proof goes through automatically. So that's something that you have to beware. And this happens most frequently if you have a function where some of the arguments change in the recursive call. Of course, the recursion argument will always change. It'll get smaller. But there might be other arguments that also change. And those are typically the arguments where you have to say arbitrary, because you will need different values in the recursive call, values that are different from the initial value that you started with. And that's the main point of this exercise, of this example, is to show A, this generalization from a constant to a variable, and B, this generalization of universally quantifying the variable. Now, you might be asking, why doesn't the induction proof method universally quantify over all the variables? Wouldn't that be simpler? In principle, yes. And in 90% of the cases, it would actually make life simpler. On the other hand, there are 10% of the cases where this additional universal quantifier makes the proof harder, because you now have more freedom. You have an induction hypothesis where fewer things are fixed, and therefore, if you think of proof search, the proof search gets more complicated. And that's the trade-off that we have here. We have opted for trying to keep the proof search simple and only quantifying those variables that the user wants quantified. The others are left unquantified, and therefore they don't cause additional work. Okay, so question about this reverse example, or itref example. Then let's go back to the slides. So this was an exercise in generalization, and those are the two points to take away. Generalization you frequently have to replace constants, or maybe also whole sub-expressions by variables, and you have to generalize the free variables, and the recommended way of doing it is by arbitrary in your induction proof. Typically, you'll have to, either you can be very naive about it and write in every induction, you write arbitrary all the other variables, the non-induction variables, or what I tend to do is try and do the induction, and then I see it doesn't quite work. Why doesn't it work? Oh, I see there's a mismatch here. I need to make some variables arbitrary, and then I do that gradually. Now, something equally important about inductions, namely beyond structural inductions. All the inductions we saw so far were structural, that we just got these induction principles from the data type, that we had to prove that every constructor of the data type preserved the property, that if the arguments had the property, then the result of applying the constructor also had the property. That can be a bit too cumbersome, and there is that works well if the functions are primitive recursive, whatever that means. And all our functions were primitive recursive so far, but later on they will not always be. And so this is what happens here. In each instruction step, one constructor is added, and in each recursive call, one constructor is removed. But now we want to introduce more complex induction patterns and recursion patterns. And here is a very simple example, the diff2 function that divides a natural number by 2, and diff2 of 0 is 0, and diff2 of successor of 0 is also 0, and if you have successor of n, then it's sac of diff2 of n.
And this is no longer of this simple pattern where we peel off one constructor in every step, because here in the recursion we have peeled off two successors and reduced it from suck of n down to n. And if you want to prove things about this function and you do it by structural induction, it'll be a complicated proof. It's better to use the proof principle that comes out of this function definition. And the proof principle that comes out of this function definition is that if you want to prove something for all natural numbers, it suffices, you prove it for zero, you prove it for one, because those are the non-recursive cases, and you prove it for suck of n, assuming that it holds for n. That is a valid induction principle for the natural number that doesn't start at zero and adds one, but it covers two base cases, zero and one, and then always adds two. So this is the rule, and it's really, this is the name of the rule, and this is what it looks like, and it's automatically generated by the system, in fact, proved by the system from the function definition as a consequence, is this rule. If you want to prove P of m for some arbitrary m, you prove it for 0, for 1, and you prove that P of n implies P of suck of n. And this is exactly a tailor-made induction principle for this function. If you wanted to prove something about the function diff 2, this would be the right thing to do it. It gives you exactly the case distinctions as you need them for this function definition. Does this induction pattern makes sense, or are there any questions about this pattern? This rule. Oh, there is of course something missing here. In reality, there's this here. Here you have to prove it for an arbitrary but fixed n that from here you can get to there. So that's where in an induction these local variables are introduced that you see as a prefix in your subgoals. So let's look at an example. I hope it's in that file. It's a different example, but it's same situation. We have again a function that we already saw, but this function doesn't follow this primitive recursion pattern where you peel off one constructor, but it almost does, but here on the left hand side is more complicated. So here's an example of a property that I would like to prove about this function, namely that it's the same if you first separate here on the left a list of x's with a, and then you map f over it. So you apply f to all the elements in that list here. Well, that could equally be done by first mapping f over all the elements in the list. Oops. And then separating them, but of course now not with a, but with f of a. And if you prove that by structural induction on x's, you will have to make another case distinction by hand. You can already see that, because structural induction will give you two cases. It'll give you the empty list, okay, that one will go away, and it'll give you a list with one element at the beginning. But then for the sep function, you have to ask yourself, well, is this a single list or a singleton list, or is there a second element in there? So you have to perform this additional case distinction. Here, the system will perform this too for you. If you, in your induction method, you explicitly say, please use the induction rule sep.induct that the system generated for me from the sep definition. Let's look at it. Theorem sep.induct. That's exactly the theorem that we saw on the previous slide. No, it's not. It's more complicated. We didn't look at the on the slide. We didn't look at sep. We looked at diff 2. Here, it's the proof principle for sep, and you can see it's now a property. It's about proving a property p of two arguments, because the sep function has two arguments, and here is the
base case 1 with the empty list, base case 2 with the single element list, and then induction step where you have to prove that if it worked for the list YZs, then it should also work for the list where you add one element. And this is the principle that comes out of this function definition, and if we apply it, we get these three properties to be proved. The first property is if we, where we replace the, where is it? There it is. Where we replace the list by the empty list, and that will go through very simply because sep of the empty list is just the empty list, and up here map of map f empty list is the empty list. Separating is again the empty list, so everything here collapses down to the empty list. Here with the single element list, it's also very easy to see why does that work. Well, if you first separate the single element list with A's, you again have X. And if you map F over the list with X in it, you just get F of X. And that's exactly what you get over here, what you get here. Here you get map F over X, gets the F of X, and the separation function doesn't do anything because the argument is a single element. And the only thing where really some work needs to be done is here. But everything really goes through automatically with this extended induction principle. You can, just as a, just to see what I claimed earlier, if you just do induction on axis and then do auto, you can see you get two subgoals. Auto can prove the first one, the second one it can't prove, and then you have to manually make a case distinction on whether this first element AA here is, on whether this list here is the empty list, then you're in another base case, or whether it's a non-empty list, and that's just tedious, and therefore this is the right way to do it. Questions? Yep. You're asking about this?
Yeah.
So, good question, because that's the one thing I did not explain. So that will come on the next slide, but I can already say it now. So here you're proving, you're performing induction using the recursion pattern that comes from some function, and the induction rule that was generated from that function definition will have as many arguments, so to speak, as the function had arguments. So there will be two things. If you look at this, theorem sep.induct, then you can see your property P will be a property of two things in that schema that it's showing at the bottom. And so you need to say, what are those two things? And that's why you're now list giving both A and X's. So the A is this A, and the X's is this X's. And the, again, heuristic is that if you use one of these special induction principles, A, you have to give here a list of ideally variables, and the list must be as long as there are arguments. And what you should just look for some call of the function which has only variables as arguments, and then use that list of variables. So this is essentially what the induction principle, the heuristic that I've been following, because you have to somehow single out one of the recursive calls, and you say, I'm doing induction on that recursive call. And this is essentially one way of saying it. So on the next slide, this will be given in more general terms. So this is the situation. You have a function f, and just to start the description, we have simplified method. We're assuming f is just a single argument function from some type tau to some type tau prime.
and you have defined it by fun, and then a special induction schema is just a word. In the system, to the system, it's just a theorem that it's proving. It's provided and proved. You can prove properties P of X for arbitrary X of type of the argument type. And this induction rule, this induction theorem, will correspond directly to the recursion equations using this pattern. This pattern. So there will be, in the induction rule, there will be one implication to be proved for each defining equation. So if you have a defining equation of the function f of some expression equals, and then on the right-hand side you have recursive calls of f on arguments r1 to rk. Of course, there might be no recursive call, in which case k is zero. Then this means in the corresponding induction step, you have to prove P of E, P of the left-hand side, assuming P of the right-hand side arguments R1 to RK. So note, the F completely disappears from the induction schema. The induction schema is essentially just following the development of the arguments of F. How do they become smaller? And then the induction goes the other way around, assumes that for the smaller arguments, the R1 to RK, the property holds, and now we have to show that it's for the bigger argument, it also holds. And that, of course, matches precisely that function definition, but it could be used for other function definitions that are of a similar nature. Yeah, so this is the thing to remember. And I'll let you in on a secret. Sometimes in exams, I will actually ask what the induction scheme is that corresponds to a particular function definition. So it's a good idea to understand what's going on here. So this is the basic principle, and here you can see it again quite clearly. This is the diff2 example now, not the set example. For every equation that we have up here, we have in the induction theorem, we have one thing to prove. So here, we prove it unconditionally for the argument 0, unconditionally for the argument 1, because there are no recursive calls on the other side. Here, we have to prove it conditionally, so this should be easier because we have an assumption here. We have to prove it for the argument on the left-hand side, the suck of n, and we can assume it for the argument on the right-hand side, the n. So this is exactly what we have here. Questions about this principle in general? Then, this is a motto. If you have some function which isn't of this very simple form, where in each recursion you simply remove the outermost constructor of the recursive argument, then most likely you will need this induction schema. How to apply it? And now I look at the more general case. We have a function f of n arguments. I didn't want to look at the general case on the previous slide because the notation just becomes too cumbersome. But here we really need to look at the general case. And this is the corresponding proof method to apply induction on f. Or not induction on f, that's somehow the wrong, it's computation induction, it follows the computation of f, but the f is no longer present in the induction rule, it's just the relationship of the original argument to the recursive argument, to the smaller argument, that's embodied in the induction rule. And this is what it has to look like, so you have to give n arguments that you want to induct on. The heuristic is that there should be some call of this form f, the thing that you induct on, with these arguments that should be in your goal, and ideally the AI should all be variables. And most of the time you will have such a situation. And here I've done it the other way around. I've shown first the example and then generalized it on the slides. It was meant to be the other way around. So that would be the end of computation induction and the end of induction, and we have another quarter of an hour left, and I would like to start introducing simplification. Because so far I've just waved my hands and said, oh yeah, auto tries to simplify things and it does things from left to right. It helps if one has a more precise understanding of what auto does, and this is what I'm trying to convey in the following material. So I've said this again, simplification means you use the equations from left to right, and you do so as long as possible, and that's in red because that might be very long. So there is the danger, the possibility, that some proof methods will simply not terminate because they use simplification and they use simplification ad infinitum. So in the context of functional programming, the danger is reduced because your programs are only accepted if they terminate. On the other hand, you can easily prove lemmas that you make simplification rules that now introduce a loop. So that's why also when you prove a lemma and make it a simplification rule, you should beware. Yes, so I'm already using that terminology. Logically, they are equations. It doesn't matter which way around, but operationally they're just used in one direction, and that's why they're often called simplification rule, although that is somewhat misleading in the sense that it's not clear. Well, something should become simpler, but sometimes it's not syntactically simpler. That term might become syntactically bigger, but some other crucial aspect of the term might change and become simpler. And that's yet another terminology. Simplification is often also called term rewriting. And here's a simple example of that process. So assume we have these four equations defining, the first two equations define the addition function. We have already seen them. And the second two equations are more interesting. They define the less than or equal relationship on natural numbers. And the first one says that if there's a successor on both sides, so if you're basically saying m plus 1 is less or equal n plus 1, well, that's the case if and only if m is less or equal n. And, well, 0 is less or equal any natural number, so that's equal to true. So assume those are the four equations that we are using to now simplify some statement. And this is the statement that we have. As an example, and now what does rewriting do? Rewriting will try and use those equations from left to right to rewrite, to modify this statement. It's not guaranteed to lead to a nice result, but let's just see what happens. So which of these equations is applicable here? Just shout it out. One is applicable, indeed, because we have here 0 plus something. Is another equation applicable? Yeah, 2 is also on the right-hand side applicable here. Since it may confuse that I've put parentheses around there, strictly speaking, I don't need those parentheses. That's why here I've dropped them, but it really does match. So both of these are applicable, and let's just, for no particular reason, apply number 1, and then you use this equation, and you replace 0 plus successor of 0 by the left-hand, by the second argument successor of 0. So now we don't have a choice. Now only equation 2 matches. There are no other matching equations here. So we use equation 2 and pull the successor that's in front of the first argument to the outside. What's applicable now?
Again
what?
Number 1.
Indeed, number 1 is there applicable. Which other equation?
3,
because we have a less than or equal with the successor on both sides. And this time we choose the 3 and remove the successor. So this is the equation that we're using. And now we have 0 less than or equal 0 plus x. And now we have, again, 2 applicable equations. Number 1, to do something here, or we can use number 4 and directly reduce the whole term to true, and that's what we're doing. And that's essentially what the system is doing. Now, it has a built-in strategy. You shouldn't rely on that, because at some point we might change the strategy, but the built-in strategy is that it does the simplification bottom-up. I think the example.
So it uses some kind of forward chain.
Pardon?
It uses some kind of forward chain in the logic.
No, forward chain, I would only use that term if you have an implication, but there's no implication here. It's just, it's really just equality, substituting equals by equals. Things can be more complicated. You can also have conditional rewrite rules. So that means you have an equation here, and you have additional preconditions. And the way the system works is that it'll try and use that conditional equation. It'll actually first try unconditional ones, because they are, of course, nicer. And then if it can't find any unconditional ones, it'll try conditional ones. But before it applies this replacement of L by R, it will and it has to first prove the preconditions, P1 to PK. And it will do so recursively by simplification. And so this is a good place where if your proof does get stuck, this is what quite likely happened. You used a conditional equation, and the precondition again led to a simplification call, and that maybe led to another simplification call, and so on. So this is another way of getting an infinite recursion going with the simplification, because the preconditions are also simplified and may again involve conditional rewriting. And here's an example of where things do go, nothing bad happens, but just to demonstrate the principle. Let's assume we have exactly those 2 equations, nothing else. P of 0 is true, and here we have an implication. If little p of x, then f of x equals g of x. And then if we have a term f of 0, that term can be simplified. Why? You can try and use this equation and replace f of 0 by g of 0, but then you first have to prove p of 0. Oh, but you can do so. You can replace p of 0 by true, and so it's been proved. But on the other hand, you can't simplify f of 1. The system will just leave f of 1 as it is, because in order to prove to simplify f of 1, you would have to prove p of 1. But p of 1 is not provable. None of the equations tell you anything about what p of 1 is. So the system will just stop at that point. In fact, the system will frequently say things like, give you a warning, I couldn't even simplify the goal, to show you you were trying to do something that has zero effect. And this you could regard as forward chaining. From the P of X, you get this equation. Now, I already alluded to termination and that there are certain dangers. The system uses these simp rules almost blindly from left to right. So it does a minimal check. It'll check that if you give it an equation as a simplification rule, that the equation by itself doesn't diverge. But if you give it 2 equations, then it won't do that anymore. And if you give it those 2 equations as simplification rules, it'll just, whenever it sees an F, it'll go away and never come back. You can tell by the coloring on the screen that something like that is happening. If your proof command turns purple and your fan starts to work, then you know that the system is trying to prove something and will probably not come back. I mean, You can give it 5 seconds, 10 seconds, but I think that at that point you interrupt, and the only way to interrupt is you have to modify that command there. For example, by typing a space or by undoing what you did and what got you into the situation. So, what's the principle? You should have at least some minimal intuition about what, how you avoid this non-termination. If it's all function definitions, then the termination is enforced by the system, and it'll complain if you give it a non-terminating function. But if it's additionally these simplification rules that are just arbitrary lemmas, then you need some intuition. And the principle is, if you have some such conditional equation, under the preconditions P1 to PK, L is equal to R, then you should only use that as a simplification rule if the left-hand side is bigger than both the right-hand side and the preconditions. And this is in quotes, bigger in some sense that you have to figure out. As I said, often it's syntactically bigger, but sometimes it's a more involved property. And often you won't have a precise idea. It'll just appear somehow this seems simpler than the other one. And why do we need L to be bigger than both the right-hand side? Bigger than the right-hand side makes sense because you want to become smaller so to terminate, but also bigger than the preconditions because otherwise, when you start to use that rule, you might start with a small term, but then in order to prove the preconditions, your term gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and so this should really be the biggest term here. And here is a simple example of two conditional rewrite rules that are potentially useful as simplification rules, and you should look at them for a moment and then try to decide for yourself, and then we will take a vote whether number one or number two or both of them. Well, actually, I can tell you one of them is not suitable, one of them is suitable as a conditional rewrite rule, and you should just look at them and figure out which one you think is suitable. So, who thinks number two is suitable? One, two. Who thinks number one is suitable? Yeah. Good. That's that was probably three times as many for number one. And indeed, this is the right intuition. Why? What's the problem with number two? Why didn't some of you didn't like number two? So why? Yep.
The condition is bigger than the left.
Yep. And you can see that the result of what's happening then, if you ask, for example, the question is, I can just ask the arbitrary. Maybe I just have two variables x and y, and I ask that. I have a subterm, x is less than y, and ask the system to simplify it, then the system will say, number two is potentially applicable. All I need to do is I need to prove successor of x less than y. Number two is applicable. All I need to do is to prove successor of x is less than y. And there the recursion starts. So this is really the conflict, is that this is bigger than this. And I think this is really the best point to stop and have a good weekend, wet and cold weekend, I think it will be. And we'll see you again next Friday.